Right now, it is time for the Christmas Eve edition of the Media Beat with David Tarajuk. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast on the weekend and also, of course, online at robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, click on the Media Beat with David Tarajuk. David is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and his website is a great website, themediabeat.us, and we say good morning and happy holidays to David Tarajuk. Good morning, David.
Well, hello there. I'm happy to be coming to you once again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and I'm very happy to be chatting with the sharply observant Marshall Miles. Marshall, it's one of those weeks when, for all the various troubles besetting us here in the U.S., I'm for one anyway, glad I'm not a journalist in Russia. If we were working in Russia, you and I, this would be a really big news day indeed. The really massive media event there, as it is every year at this time, is what's known as simply the big press conference. And of course, everyone knows who's involved. It's Big Vlad, President Vladimir Putin. Incidentally, just 5'6" tall, by the way, not so big in himself. Same height as Napoleon, interestingly. This is the time that he makes himself available to the nation's press, and some of the world's press, too, to answer questions. Literally hundreds of reporters get to fall over themselves to get a question in to the great man. Numbers have been limited by COVID this year, so there were yesterday only 500 eager questioners this time, not all of whom got to ask what was on their mind, but of course some did, even though the whole shebang went on for 4 hours or so, and the important reporting to do is to ask, were there any surprises coming out of the press conference? Guess what? There were not. No surprises at all. For instance, with 100,000 of his troops massing along the border with the Ukraine, Putin said it wasn't him who's been increasing tensions there. Should we play the guessing game again? Who was it? It was the West, us in the West, who's to blame for the tense situation. Doing something that, apparently we are doing something that Putin described in a colorful turn of phrase as the West is coming with its missiles to the porch, the very porch of Russia's house. Well, a media event for some, less interest for us in the rest of the world. Though, of course, it's important to keep tabs on what kind of noises he is making about that evidently planned invasion, if we can draw that assumption from all the troops on the border with Ukraine. Let's hope it doesn't come to that. And, of course, the NATO allies are making clear in messaging of their own that they don't believe there's any other cause for the increased tension other than Putin himself. It's another case of the pot calling the kettle black, I suppose.
I saw the news article on the news conference, it's interesting to see the way he operates. You can think what you want about him, but from his intelligence and from his behind-the-scenes dirty work over the years before he became president and the leader, he learned very well what Russia will accept from a leader. He really has.
Sure, and he models himself on previous instances of Russian leadership. One of the things that he's particularly canny about in the big conference every year is making sure that journalists from the outer regions of what was once the Soviet Empire get a chance to raise issues that are local to them. Often, it's a clever trick. It makes him look like a generous leader, a benevolent czar, you might even say. When he takes, he will suddenly pay attention to some relative. In the national picture, a relatively minor problem in a region, but he can look like the decisive person who can set things right when he can say very forcefully about an individual small problem raised in a region, we can fix that, and I'll get my people onto it right away. It has that brisk leadership look about it, that it's all part of this exercise's plan to achieve. He's not alone in that. A lot of leaders do that. They often make a point of peppering their press conferences with opportunities to demonstrate brisk dealing with problems that arise.
Shall we bring in our fanfare?
Oh, yes, please. Let's hear the bugle. A fanfare for some classic illustrative journalism this week. It's not for the first time, but whenever it happens, it's always worth noting. It's in my hometown newspaper, the New York Times. This week they did a really valuable piece of work that adds poignancy and understanding to one likely result of the scuppering by Senator Joe Manchin of President Biden's huge big back better plan. That result of this scuppering in the Senate could be the ending this month, this very month, the end of December, of Biden's dramatic expansion of American families' child tax credit. You remember that's the much-needed money that he made available so much more fully than ever before back earlier this year in the summer. The plan was that this the next big package that he's trying to get through and is now being scuppered by Senator Manchin, would, if not make that tax credit permanent, then at least extend it well into the future. And the question of how important has such an addition to families' budgets proven to be, and how much will it be missed now that it's being stopped? Well, the Times decided to find out on the ground. Good old-fashioned shoe-leather reporting. It was employed here to give us a sense of the nitty-gritty of ordinary families' financial lives, the day-to-day expenses that they were able to use this newly arrived set of funds for, used for doctor's appointments, to car repairs, and overall the breathing room, I guess, that the cash provided for households who are well used to living paycheck to paycheck. The broad sweep of this journalism got refined down to, in classic journalistic storytelling form, to just four examples spread across the United States. One, for instance, was, let me quote the instances, or a couple of them. Maya and Thaddeus Bennett in Las Vegas, an African-American couple who have two kids aged 3 and 4. With those two kids, from July, they started receiving $600 a month. Both parents have been working, though against against some difficulties, with Thaddeus combining several part-time jobs until he recently landed a regular full-time job with a finance company. But the main point about the tax credit funds is that they came into the family budget, and they were, as a consequence, they've been able to now afford, for the first time, daycare for both their children. That's set them into a position a lot more comfortable than they were before. But still, of course, living on the edge. Similarly, if I scroll down the story, there's a white couple in Virginia, Blaine and Kayla Midson, who are small business owners. They have twins of 10 and an older child of 12. Their business, it's an ice cream parlor, had been hard hit by COVID, I'm afraid. The two adults have been taking on part-time gigs on the side to keep their heads above water. And with the three kids, they managed to... they just simply received $750 a month, and that's had to go into their business to prevent it from sinking. So you can see how much these evidently small but very significant bundles of money have been helping people. And who knows? And this goes for all the families that the Times surveyed, not just the four that they published, how things will go when this very welcome support from those tax credits, when it stops. We should just give a tip of our hat for the detailed reporting there of Alisha Haridasani Gupta, along with, by the way, some greatly evocative real-life photography by Cornell Watson. It's one of those cases where one big splash of a feature story tells much more than just the simple description of the story tells. It's a fine piece of, as I say, very detailed work. The devil is in the detail, and the beauty is in the detail. We got a real understanding of life on the edge from this story.
You know, and when we go back to Manhattan and what his opposition, very interesting this week when a big segment of his population, the coal industry, came out and said, hey, you should reconsider, because what you're blocking is additional black lung resources for miners. And what you're blocking is retraining programs and the millions of dollars for our miners who are losing their jobs. It's going to be interesting to see how that weighs in over the course of the next couple of months with Manette, when he once again starts renegotiating with the administration.
Sure. Well, you know, the argument is not yet over. I'm saying that the child credit example, for instance, is now being stopped. Well, that may be the case. I mean, the terrible thing about getting legislation through the Senate now with such a finely balanced set of numbers either side, Democrat and Republican, is that it takes at the very simplest and the very most straightforward fact of all, is that it takes so long to negotiate, especially such a big package as Biden is attempting to get through here. And yes, Manchin was very clear, or appeared to be very clear anyway, when on Fox News, an interesting venue in which to choose to make this announcement, that he could no longer support it. And he sounded very categorical. But yes, negotiations will continue. The long process will just get longer. Yeah, and in his case on this issue, yes, he's got his own conflicted pressures. He is associated with the coal industry. That's without a doubt. The main coal miners' union in Virginia are very clear about how he's leaving them in the lurch over this issue of funding for black lung disease. That's something that I don't think any politician would ever want to have on their record, that they blocked funds for such an obviously much needed humanitarian bit of government spending. But that's what he's ended up doing. There are two sides, of course, in every industry. There's capital and there's labor, if you want to be analytical about it. And of course, we mustn't ever forget. I'm not sure what exactly this entails in terms of the political calculus that Senator Manchin makes in such matters. But his family, Manchin's own family, is amongst the coal mining owner side of the equation. On the other hand, we also must remember that as with many people in that part of the world, family members have also been workers in the industry too. In fact, I believe he lost a relative, perhaps an uncle, if I'm not mistaken, killed in the mining work that he did. So yeah, he's he's got his own calculations to make, and as we know, they have changed over time. For instance, on this one issue that this fine piece of illustrative journalism that the Times did on the child tax credit, Manchin voted for that tax credit back in the early part of this year. It came into effect in July, but he's made it very clear he's against it, or the against the extension of it beyond December of this year.
Interesting, but you pointed out that whichever, you know, when you have a 50-50 split, and you don't have, I don't think there's very few liberal Republicans, if any, that can counteract the conservative Democrats. So it makes getting legislation passed quickly near impossible.
Yeah, there's not a single Republican vote to be counted on in these matters, and that's why Manchin and, of course, his cohort in several of the issues, Senator Sinema, are so vital to the Biden plan. It gives them outsized power. There's been speculation in the press, of course, that Manchin might want to decouple from the Democratic Party completely, and perhaps well, he's not going to join the Republicans, I don't think, but the possibility of him becoming an independent and just caucusing as and when it pleased him with the Democrats is a possibility. But he's got a lot more power, of course, as part of the Democratic side. If he were to go in a different direction, then of course with Senator O'Connell as the Democrat leader, as the Republican leader. Whoops! What a slip there. Yeah. Senator O'Connell as the as the Republican leader, he'd just be one of many, and his influence would, of course, shrink to a minuscule state. So he's better placed where he is. For many more liberal-minded Democrats, he's, of course, something of a bugbear. But that is the nature of the numerology here. It's an outsized amount of power for an individual senator when things are as finely balanced as they are.
I just think modern-day liberals and progressives have to understand that it was this way back when John Kennedy was president and when Lyndon Johnson took over with the Dixiecrats. It's always been a tough struggle between that end of the party and the other party. And you know, in some weird way, they both need one another to get what they want.
It is a broad church, the Democratic Party. We know that, and yet, as you say, some people who are getting as angry as they are with Manchin rather forget that it was always this way. You're quite right.
Well, I want to go to another story that actually happened in April, and that was the shooting death, which the officer claimed was a taser mix-up. Well, the jury came back and found that officer guilty of manslaughter.
Yes, and of course it's vitally important to recognize that it happened in Minnesota. Kim Potter, the former officer, found guilty of manslaughter of Dante Wright, a young black man, killed in a traffic stop because, she claimed, she mixed up her taser with her gun, and while drawing a weapon and shouting out the word taser, she in fact drew a gun and shot him, and he while still driving away, that was the point of the exercise, she claimed, to stop him driving away, while shot, he drove away and even crashed into a couple of other people, injuring one person very seriously, and he himself is dead. This happened in Minnesota, the very place where the George Floyd case was of course front of mind for everyone while this case was going on, and once again we get the nation, aghast at the position demonstrated so often of black people in confrontations with the police, confrontations that obviously have an entire different. I say obviously, it's become more and more clear as we see these patterns repeated and repeated and repeated, that there is an injustice that is endemic to the situations where white officers are in conflict with, for whatever, sometimes rather spurious reasons, in conflict with black motorists in particular. The classic, the horribly classic now case of a black individual being pulled over, in that terrible phrase, driving while black. In the case of Daunte Wright, the thing that evidently drew the police's attention, Officer Potter being accompanied by a young trainee in this case, and they were being somewhat punctilious in pulling someone over who had an air freshener dangling from the rearview mirror. That in itself is some kind of offense in Minnesota, and that was the initial cause for this pulling over happening. And of course, everything went in a horrible direction thereafter. But she's found guilty. A diverse, but not terribly, not very diverse, jury found her guilty. The next stage, of course, is sentencing, and it looks, from the flavor of this court case, as if there will be a substantial penalty imposed in the sentencing phase. She could be going to jail for several years.
Yeah, driving while black, I always go back to 2 years ago. I had a white, very beautiful a car that had total blackout windows, okay, and it had nice rims and it had 20-inch wheels. And we're coming up out of New York on Route 22, and we were pulled over. And as I was looking in the rearview mirror, the officer got out, had his hand on his hip, and then, you know, touched the back of my car and slowly came up and then tapped on the window. As I rolled down the window, the expression in his face changed, because there, sitting in the driver's seat, was a 65-year-old heavyset white guy and a woman. And he said, "Everything okay there?" And I said, "Yeah. Is there any reason I got pulled over?" And he said, "Are these windows legally tinted?" I said, "Yes, but can you do anything about them in New York if they weren't?" And he said, "No." "Well, have a good day, sir." And he left. And I looked over at Jill and I said, "There you go, Jill. They really thought we were blacks in this car."
That's an assumption that's perfectly understandable. Yeah. On your part, to assume that that's what was in his mind as he approached you. We can't know that for sure, course, but there's such abundant evidence now when you look at the numbers of who does get pulled over and for what kind of suspected offense, too. Within the broader canvas of the claim of the pressing of claims for racial justice now, especially when it comes to the matter of police use of force, I think it is so well established now that this is endemic and systemic in the sense that it operates throughout the police system in all sorts of jurisdictions, and it really has to be tackled seriously. And Minnesota is an interesting case. They seem to be taking the lead in attempting to do something that gets to the root of the problem. Defunding the police is not the phrase that helps the argument at all, but restructuring and bringing the police to a lower degree of involvement in the small, relatively small, but often very troubling incidents that require judicious treatment. When small things go wrong, it's important to prevent them from escalating into big, horrible, fatal things. And there are ways of doing that. And if police forces and local jurisdictions can get the balance right between police officers themselves and their training, and you know, real life incidents where you know more subtlety is needed than what many police officers seem capable of offering. That's the only way, I think, to get this terrible stain on police forces' reputations across the entire country, to get that sorted out in any satisfying way as we move forward.
And one final story, which I shouldn't get a laugh out of, but I did. When the jurors in the Maxwell sex trafficking trial were asked to continue the deliberations after 16 hours of deliberations wrapped up on Wednesday, the jury looked at the judge and said, "No, we'll come back Monday."
Yeah, I think they quickly returned verdict in that case, I think.
Yeah. But just no, thank you, Judge. We'll come back Monday. We'll have our Christmas and come back Monday. Anyway, there's a lot of hope to look forward to in this country, in this world. And this is the season to grab onto those things. David, it's always great to check with you. I guess we'll do a year-end wrap and look into the new year next week.
That's the tradition for journalists at this time of year. I hope you have a very good Christmas.
David, take care, and Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays.
You too. Bye-bye now.
The Media Beat with David Tarachuk. You can find David at his website, themediabeat.us. That's themediabeat.us.